Hello and welcome to Boomeranging, from expat to repat, a podcast that explores the question, what could be so hard about returning home after years living overseas? I'm your host, Margot Anderson, and in each episode, I will sit down with a former Aussie expat to discuss how they survived repatriation and reverse culture shock, how they navigated the logistics of careers, friends, and family to successfully find their new place at home, and all without losing their global spirit. If you have just returned home, are thinking about it, or just love a good yarn told by professional globetrotters, then I have no doubt you'll enjoy meeting this diverse group of Australians. Come home with a plan and you can reduce your anxiety about returning by 50% is the advice Mark Lindley gives in our podcast chat. On paper, Mark looks like he had a head start on most long-term expats returning home. He was already a senior HR director when he left Australia for 12 years in the Middle East, where he continued his career with several global companies. Managing organisational change, recruitment and teams of thousands of people should make him an expert on his own HR and transition challenges coming home, right? As Mark explains, yes and no. Coming home, he and his wife knew they needed a plan. They knew they needed a new home city to keep their adventure going. Mark knew he needed to reconnect with his contacts and make new ones. He knew he needed to find a way to make his last 12 years in the Middle East relevant for employers in the Gold Coast and Southeast Queensland. What Mark didn't know was the great success he could have with contracts and the career opportunities could emerge. He didn't know what joy he would find settling on the Gold Coast and emulating some of his Dubai lifestyle back home. Mark also didn't realise he would become such a magnet for other expat friends asking him how he did it. This podcast explores Mark's how and his advice for the big move home, an experience he believes can be more daunting than moving overseas in the first place. So welcome, Mark.
Thank you, Margot. Thank you for today. I'm privileged and excited.
Where are we chatting with you today?
I'm actually at home. I work from home currently on a contract that I'm involved in on the Gold Coast.
It's the place to be, I think, in August in Australia. So beautiful part of the world at that time.
I think it's a place to be. Anybody that says where you're working from, I say the Gold Coast, I don't think anyone has turned around and said, gee, that's a terrible place. They all say, how did you get that? How did you work that out?
Well, that's what we're keen to find out, I think. But before we do dive into some of the details about where you are today, I'm really keen to wind the clock back and just hear a little bit about what you were doing before you went away, because you had quite a significant career before you jumped on the plane and headed offshore.
Absolutely. My wife and I, we were living in Sydney, right in the middle of the CBD. I actually could see the town hall clock from the lounge room window. So we were right in the hub of it. Both my wife and I had extraordinary jobs. We'd been prolific travellers up until we moved to Dubai. We probably travelled to in excess of around 65 countries. So we'd travelled quite a lot. For me, professionally, I'd been in HR for over 15 years at a senior level. I'd worked in FMCG. I'd worked in retail. I'd worked in health. And really, my wife and I thought, look, what would be the ultimate journey? And the ultimate journey would be living life, as I say, under a different sun. Now, I didn't know how long that would be. However, we thought, well, what's the plan? How would we make that happen? We had this beautiful apartment that we leased out. We saved really hard. We said, look, let's get 6 months together. We leased out the apartment. We bought two tickets and we booked into the Four Point Sheraton on Sheikh Zayed Road for 30 days. And
The rest is history.
And the rest is history. It was probably the greatest unknown that we'd ever travelled into.
So Dubai was actually, as you said, a well-planned adventure, but I'm keen to understand why Dubai.
Look, it's a great question, and it's interesting how many times that comes up. Initially, and I think proximity-wise, and again, as I said, we had travelled a lot, we were looking at Singapore and Hong Kong. It was a very buoyant market in both of those countries. The challenge really was that the level of expertise in both of those countries was very high, compounded the fact that they were multilingual. So that was probably a bit of a challenge because we really would have had to immerse ourselves not only in the many things of the culture, we'd really need to pick up the language. And I know a lot of people say, well, look, everybody speaks English, but as you know, go under the layer, that's really not the case. People that we had heard about that had moved to Dubai, and actually we got online and read a lot of blogs, and a lot of people sort of said, you know, the plan for Dubai is get on a plane and just go for it. And reached out to a few people, made some contacts, some search firms over there. And they said, look, we think you've got everything that Dubai wants, but you've got to be over here, as many other people did. So they said, you know, if you really want to go forward with this, literally land and we'll talk. And that's what we did. So it was a big leap.
I know you've shared with me off air that, you know, you and your wife didn't purchase a home for the first year in Dubai. And I suspect that that was, you know, waiting to see how life and career would unfold. But there must have been a tipping point somewhere. And I'm interested to know what made you think, okay, we might be here for a while.
Look, I can sum that up in three letters, GFC.
Oh, okay.
The global financial crisis. When we arrived there, my wife and I lived a controlled or conservative life. So we were living in a small studio apartment just in Dubai, but what they call old Dubai. You know, we got jobs quite quickly, and that was, I think, reflective of, you know, just the market at the time, a highly buoyant market. And anyway, we started to explore what would it be like to live there. And to live there, you need to really sort of ground. And the best way to ground yourself is not take out a 12-month rental lease, but look at property. And at the time, it was a property boom, the UAE in particular, but Dubai specifically goes in highs and lows, and it was at the high. Then probably 6 months after we were there, the global financial crisis hit, and property value literally, Margot, dropped by between 60 to 70%. So what we dreamed about became a reachable reality, because we went, right, well, if that's the prices, let's go back and start making some offers. And we did. And I think once you own and live there, it's a very, very different dynamic to your life from that day forward.
And I guess there's some longevity in terms of how people see you being there and engage with you accordingly, right?
Absolutely. When you go for interviews, people will, you know, and even in discussions. So where do you live? You tell them where you live. And did you buy? And you go, yes, I bought. And it does, as you rightly say, take it to a different level.
So you had several senior roles while you were in Dubai, including one that saw you split your time between the US and the Middle East. Can you take me through some of the roles that you had and what you were doing over that 12 years?
Sure. The first role that I got was with the Emirates Group, and I was working in a company or a division of their group security. I was the group HR director. It was a headcount of around about 55,000 employees. The group security had an arm called TransGuard, and TransGuard was a division where they looked at a whole array of end-to-end security and facility provisions. Their strength in being established at such a large company was through acquisitions, and they had made a tremendous amount of acquisitions. They had repainted cash vans overnight and given people new uniforms. However, what wasn't happening was the integration. So a big part of my role was getting that integrated through establishing a shared service function, redefining the different business units, and putting in policies and processes that are really going to keep employees engaged and a good model for attraction for new candidates. Somebody asked me, you know, sum that up. I just say that was wild days.
And you hang on with both hands and just say yes and go for the ride.
Absolutely. And because of the influence in the global financial crisis, contracts closed down. So there was a lot of repatriation. Repatriation was probably, I think in 1 month was, you know, probably in excess of about 12,000 people. So you're working 24/7 because the airports are open 24/7. So I moved from Emirates. I moved to a company which was a US private equity firm. And I think if it's a US company and it's private equity,
it says a lot without saying a lot.
Absolutely. I think most people can finish that sentence. And this private equity firm specialized in the oil and energy sector, and they were focusing on acquiring mid-size oil and energy companies around the globe with the strategy to put them together and, as private equity do, at some point exit by selling that particular complete brand. So I was recruited as the VP of Human Resources. It was an interesting remit because they said, well, we're making all these acquisitions. You need to just fly to these countries, do the due diligence, and get some order in what's happening from the people side. which sounded great. It was probably, it sounded much better than, you know, really it was. And I say that in the sense that when they say, you know, we're buying in countries, it's like, well, one day they were buying something in Aberdeen, Scotland, and then they're buying something in Colorado, and then they're buying something in Malaysia. So that's a lot of flop.
And trying to stick them together, right?
Yes, yes, yes. And, you know, when you'd land on a plane, for example, you'd get these emails, we've just made another acquisition. So when you're finished in this country, fly to that country. And it was probably one of the greatest career shapers for me.
Phenomenal.
Because it was just pace. It was culturally working with mid-sized businesses and getting them to understand that now they've been acquired and they're working for a different master, so to speak.
You also have shared, I think, that one day you just woke up and went, I think it's time. I think it's time. Can you tell me a little bit about that moment? And it was time, when we say it was time to head home. What was the lead up to that?
I've always been a firm believer, especially in my career, that you need to acknowledge when you've hit the peak or you're close to the peak. And I'm not saying once you hit the peak that you can't hang around there. Of course you can. But I woke up one day, probably through a long, long sort of 24/7 career over the last sort of 10, 11 years and thought, you know, I've done really well. And my wife, we had this discussion. We both had done exceptionally well. And you started to think, okay, what is the next step? And, you know, family's important. Parents are getting a bit older. You do need to then think, whether it's today, whether it's tomorrow, whenever that may happen, what is your exit plan? You need to have an exit plan. Your exit plan can't be, oh, by the way, you know, your role's been made redundant. You've got 60 days to leave the country. That's not an exit plan. Your exit plan has to be on your terms, and you need to have total control on it. And as we started to formulate what that would look like, it started to make more sense. And as it made more sense, you started to think, okay, let's look at what's the first thing we need to do, the second thing we need to do, the third thing we need to do. And, you know, of course, exiting out, I was working at a company called G4S Security. I was in a very big operation across Middle East and Asia, 220,000 employees. So, you know, you're on high octane. And then all of a sudden you're thinking, okay, so now how do I bring that down and start to look at the exit plan? And it will start to firm and formulate as you put the steps into place. I'm reiterating here, but you need an exit plan on your terms.
Couldn't agree more. And I think when you've got that plan percolating away, it's easier then to identify the timing in your own sense of control, I think is really important, because otherwise it's, you know, there's just multiple layers of how you return, because there's grief and there's, you know, all those things when opportunities have been taken away from you. I think, you know, that point of being in control is really vital.
Absolutely. And you need to be clear on what your signs of success are as well. It's not always monetary. It could be career. It could be personal, professional, cultural exchange, knowledge, whatever that is, you need to reflect on what are the things I came over to do, or what did I want to achieve when I came over here, or when I went over there, I should say, and have I achieved them?
I'm interested too, like, how did the Gold Coast come on the radar, and why did you set your sights on that area and that place? It's not a place that either you or your wife have connection to previously.
Well, look, I could say sand, both have sand. But look, I think it was a few factors. Lifestyle was part of it. The Gold Coast has a good lifestyle. It's not Dubai, but it is a great lifestyle. And how we came with Gold Coast, and this was something too that we processed, right? We both processed on the fact so many people repatriate. Now, whether it's back to Australia or the US or Europe or the UK, and they go back to the same place in the same location, and they think, oh, if I can get the same house in the same street or the same apartment, that would be fantastic. And what happens is after about 6 months, people go, oh, what happened there? You know, I spent 10 years overseas, then I came back and I'm doing the same. So for us, it was very much, how do we continue an adventure? And part of that was, let's go back to a degree into the unknown. And the Gold Coast was the unknown, of course. You go there for holidays and things. But to live there is a different thing altogether. And it just ticked all the boxes. Even though we're born and bred Sydney people, I didn't want to go back to Sydney because I felt that I was moving further down from the rest of the world. So at least the Gold Coast is still a little closer, you know. It's not 7 hours from Asia, it's only 6 hours. So that, I think, was another influence in regards to why we picked the Gold Coast.
Yeah, and I'm interested in, I guess, how that's shaped your experience of coming home, and especially from a career perspective, because I think for many, there is an appetite and a want to be brave to go to a new place and a new regional place, but there is also the reality that it is a smaller place. Now, that can have its advantages and disadvantages, but I'm interested in, you know, how did you navigate that and how did that shape your career journey?
Look, of course, one of the things that was in or the back of my mind is if I'm not going, for example, to a Sydney or a Melbourne, what's the job market going to be like? And I had a look at the market, and, you know, when you look at it through a website or reach out to a few people, you think, oh, okay, it's fine. But, you know, for me, probably the last 12, 13 years, I've always worked somehow, some way remote. I even had it when I was in Dubai, I had an office. I think in the end I said, make it a meeting room, because I was either working, I was working everywhere but in the office. And I thought, well, look, there must be, and I know in Australia we were moving to a sort of remote, flexible, hybrid type of workforce. That was my working environment, and that was my thinking. I didn't want that to dictate where I lived. There's, you know, there's that live where you want, don't live close to work because it's easy, because, you know, you need to live where you want to enjoy yourself. And so that was my thought process. So again, a bit of a risk, because when I did come back, first of all, I reached out to a lot of very good contacts that I re-engaged with and got good counsel from and met with a few. And I just said, look, you know, there is remote work out there. There's contract work out there. You should be able to sell yourself into that. And really, that's what I did. So it's not going to fall in your lap. But I think even today, the sort of hybrid, flexible working arrangements is even more so out there. But for some companies, you may need to suggest that to them.
I'm interested, just to go back a step, you talked about reaching out to your contacts and your networks. Firstly, how did you stay connected to them, or did you stay connected to them from abroad? Did they have a clear line of sight of what you'd been doing, or was there a process of re-educating them around what you'd been doing? And how did they respond?
You need to be a good networker. I know that's hard for people. I sort of enjoy a part of it. I know some people love it, and some people love it and don't do it as well as they should, and then other people don't. You do need to network. You need to be humble, however, highlighting what you're doing and working on. So to answer your question on the network back in Australia, yes, I, you know, kept people based on my postings and what I'm up to, kept them informed. Now, that may have been a bit more passive, but they were aware of what I did. I would email from time to time, have a bit of a sort of online chat with them. So I think you've got to keep that connectivity. I probably accelerated that more in the last 2 years before leaving Dubai. You know, occasionally I would get an email when I was in Dubai from Australia saying, when are you returning, or would you return? Or if you do, you know, talk to us and let us know. So there are some, how can I say, probably more progressive agents where they would be looking at firms that would be sort of saying, look, at some point this person will return. So let's also keep in touch with them. How I was received was, and I'm not just saying me, however, coming back, anybody I reached out to, they'd say, great, let's catch up for a coffee. I want to hear the whole story. So very receptive. Not all of that realized into sort of firm opportunities. But the great thing about that, Margo, is it got you to hear your story aloud with somebody else and with some very trusted people in sort of the search and recruitment industries. I'd say to them, how does that sound to you? What do you think of my story? And they'll say, look, I think it's great. However, let me explain what the Australian market is like. So you need to get that from the experts living, working, operating in the Australian market, and be bold and ask them, how does that sound? What do you think I should sort of curve a bit? What do you think needs polishing? What should I be saying more of? What should I be saying less of? Take that feedback very seriously, which I did.
I think it helps you shape the narrative, but it's to join the dots. It's note where the points of relevance are. And, you know, I think many of us are, you know, returning with like such a broad suite of skills, but we want to meet people where they're at or meet industries where they're at. And so we've got to find that those points of relevance. And so I think it's really good advice to take advice.
And ask a lot. Ask a lot of people, because if you're genuine and sincere, that will come across. And as we know, people will want to help you.
What did you realise about your experience and how you needed to shape it on your CV as part of your pitch? I mean, CVs are a big question that I often am asked about. You know, how do I take this experience and put it down into, you know, words on a page, into a document? And how did you make that relevant for the area that you were going to or the roles that you were embarking on conversations about?
I'm somebody that always looks at my CV because I'm one of those people that see it as your marketing document. And if anybody asks, there's nothing worse if you say, well, look, give me 3 days and I'll send it to you. I'm always looking at my CV. And what I did is when I came back, I didn't look at my CV. I had the discussions with a lot of people. Then I went back and reviewed my CV. And it was interesting when I started looking at my CV, I just thought there's certain areas that need to change. And again, this is my view. You need to make it relevant. Operating in 20 countries, having multi-million dollar budgets is not relevant and it doesn't translate. And so you need to look at what's the market space, how is it operating, what is it saying, and how can you get what you've done? And it's not, some people say, well, I don't want to dumb it down or I don't want to reduce it or recalibrate it. I say, don't. Just tell a different story, but a story that's relevant to the market. Of course, you'll need to change certain aspects of your CV. I would say focus more on the skills and the experience, but don't get too caught up in the work for these big companies, responsibilities and things like that, because a lot of that won't translate. Really push your skills and really push what you learned through the experience in working in certain organizations, because that's what they want. Here's our challenge. These are the skills that we needed. Does this person have it?
Absolutely great advice. I think, you know, it's leading with the what, not the where. And I think to think about, well, what challenges have I solved and what skills did I use to do that? Yeah, because challenges are shared. You know, challenges are invariably shared. They might be a different scale. They might be a different level of complexity, but the challenge is the similar piece.
Especially in the area that I work within human resources. And people sometimes say, isn't it different around the world? I'd say probably 10%.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, everywhere in the world, people want to come to work, they want to get paid, they want to be treated reasonably, they want to go home, they want to have some time off, they want to be told they've had a job well done. Trust me, whether you go to West Africa, the UK or Australia, everybody wants that.
Now, you ended up taking a contract to begin with. How was this experience and how did that then, I guess, launch you into other contracts? Because that's been your path, hasn't it? You know, contractually based work.
Correct. When I thought to myself, okay, contract could be a solid way to go, I then thought, well, what do I want to look at time-wise? And I believe that you need to look at 12 months. Now, I know some people say, well, look, there's some interim work in that. That's fine. And I'm saying, if you want to do a solid contract where the contract is actually saying, we need somebody to come in and do X, Y, Z, review it, build it, deliver it. Most cases, you need 12 months. So that really was my sort of only parameter to say 12 months. I think with going into projects, you have probably some advantage because you can push out your skills and experience a bit sooner and a bit faster. And if there's a bit of a sort of business friction or resistance to that, you can always go back to say, I've got 12 months. So we need to get traction quickly. For me, that sort of is a good approach within contracts. At the end of the day, a lot of people say, well, look, can we do, you know, I ultimately would like something full-time. There's no point in taking a full-time role if it's not going to be what you want, what you enjoy, and it's going to bring out your best value. I think the contracts give you that latitude where you can't not give enough or you can't do more than is required because they go, well, this is great. And in contracts of both the first one and where I am currently, they just continue extending because they go, well, that's a great idea. We should explore that. Can you stay longer? But you're still within that contract framework.
And you can determine whether you can align your best skill set or value to that next phase, right, of the contract. So,
yeah, I totally agree. Everybody wants, when you're talking with the contracts in particular, everybody wants action and they want it fast. And that's the good thing about a contract because you can do that.
And I'm keen to hear some of your observations, I guess, more broadly about what maybe has surprised you about the market in Australia.
I don't want to sound like I skirt around. It is smaller, and you have to accept it's a smaller market. It's a smaller population, heavily dispersed around a large continent, and operations, be it, even if they're serving international businesses, are still quite small. You need to process that and you need to think that. I think even with multinationals, they still have a localized sort of feel about them. Again, need to sort of appreciate that. I would say the reception and response from those, especially in the market that I'm, or the industry or function in HR and allied to that, have been fantastic. And that, when I say surprised, it was very good as an expatriate, but I think in a lot of cases, people were just sort of clinging on to a bit of hope. Back here, there's a genuine giving of their time, quite happy to help and very encouraging to help as and when they can. Now, I think that because we're a different lifestyle and when you're in a tornado of activity outside of Australia, people have less time, but they do have a lot more time. It is a much, much smaller market. And respect that. Understand that this is your choice. You've made that choice. Work within the parameters. Work within the framework now you're adopting.
I definitely share your sentiment around generosity. I think people are incredibly giving of their time, their knowledge, and their networks where they can. I think people genuinely want to help you. We've just got to be clear about, you know, what we need, you know, because they will be very generous in opening the doors if that's aligned.
I agree, Margot, and that's something you mentioned. Absolutely. You need, it's no point in just setting up meetings and saying to the other person, so what do you think? Go with an agenda, go with a formulated view on, this is what I'm looking at. Is it possible? As you say, especially here, people by human nature, they want to help other people, and it's a bonus if by helping them they've been successful as an outcome.
Yeah, absolutely. So flipping across to lifestyle, how's life on the Goldie?
Well, look, outside of the relaxed environment, copious great restaurants, places to go out, the weather, it's pretty tough. It's good. It's really good. Actually, when we came back, it was interesting because so many people said, especially in the early days, oh, how can you go from Dubai to the Gold Coast? And after about 6 months, I was getting concerned because I'm thinking, I feel like we've transitioned well. So I think that's mindset. But the Gold Coast is great. It's vibrant. There is a lot of great opportunity. I think you need to look a little bit below the sort of the surface. There's some great people out here. There's some great companies out here. And look, there's even, you know, good SMEs out here that are highly, highly successful. And, you know, they're looking for solid people to take them further.
And it's very connected, isn't it? You know, the airport, you know, is easy to get to from anywhere. You know, the train through to Brisbane, it's easy to commute.
I got so excited the first flight. When my wife and I came, after about 8 months, we went down to Sydney. Then we came back. I got so excited that we got off the plane and into a taxi in 15 minutes. I wanted to do it again.
Has living outside a major capital city made you rethink any career decisions?
Not necessarily. I mean, as I mentioned, you know, when we went down to Sydney, it never made me, and I love Sydney, as I said, born and bred. I love Sydney, but I never went down and thought, my goodness, why did we move to the Gold Coast? I'm a really big believer of, if you make the decision, then make it work.
And if you need to change it, you can.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. you know, actually going to let you over the border if you decide that you want to go now.
So I know, Mark, from our conversations, you've been always really generous in wanting to, I guess, help make the process easier for other expats coming home. What is the advice you would give around planning? I mean, what can you do? What do you think you simply can't do?
You can plan so much. So you can plan the logistics. Sit down and set out what that's going to look like. What do you need to do? Do you need to get out of a lease? Do you need to sell a home? Do you need to close a business? Close bank accounts, get those sort of logistical elements down on paper and the sequence of events that they need to have. I need to book flights and everything like that. Then I'd say you need to look at, well, where do you actually want to live? And as I mentioned, people have a tendency to gravitate back to where they've lived before. And they'll say, my goodness, I'm going back. I can't believe prices of housing and rents have gone up. And so I say to people, but why do you need to go back there? And they say, well, I got my family there. And I say, but can't you get on a flight and go and see your family? And I think for me, it's just sort of trying to challenge a bit of the established thinking, you know. So definitely plan the logistics, reach out and start making contacts locally, both on where you feel that you know, explore another city or another location, make those contacts. Professionally, reach out to people, start to have that conversation and start to get their feedback. Make sure you have the humility to take that feedback on, process it and use it to your advantage. Once you get through that, then when you land, don't go straight into, you know, like you plan to get over there, build a little bit of a safety net. So when you come back, you don't have to get a job tomorrow, because you'll go into a job, maybe it'll pay the bills, but is it the right job? You don't want to look like, oh, look, the expat returned, they last 6 months, now they want to move on. You know, research the market, talk to people. Really, it's a chance to do something different or diversify in what you're doing. Don't just think, I've got to get on a plane and I've got to get home and I really hope my container turns up. There's much more thinking you need to do before that happens. And get your CV right and your pitch and what you're going to deliver as well.
Yeah, that clarity piece I think is really important. And then you've got something actually to talk to your networks about, haven't you? Or to test with your networks or to invite some feedback in from your networks.
Absolutely. And the question that you made was fantastic, Margot. So why do you decide to come back? You've got to have a good story for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nothing worse when you're, you know, and I've heard some people say, well, this is what I'm thinking. What do you feel? And I say, well, it sounds like you're trying to escape the country.
Yeah. Is there a backstory somewhere that we don't know about?
let me tell you, that's not going to go over well. Go back and think about what you're leaving and think about what you'll be joining or where you're going to. One thing, if I can say, is people ask me, do you miss Dubai? And my answer is very simple. Yes, I do. And I miss Sydney. And a lot of people say and try and convince themselves because they've repatriated, well, I don't miss where I came from. I do, but it's part of my now, it's part of my life, it's part of my journey. I don't want to block it out. I want to incorporate it to where I am today. And I think that that's important. Don't shut it down. Make it part of your life. Make it part of this new journey.
Yeah, it's such amazing advice. I think, you know, it's not about landing back and closing the door. It's about how do I bring that with me in life and in career, I think, you know, so it's important. Now, Mark, we like to close all of our podcasts with five quick questions. I'm going to pose those to you now. Living overseas taught me what about myself?
I think one of the biggest, and it was progressive, is that we are far, far more similar than we are different as people.
Yeah.
From every aspect.
Lovely insight. The number one skill that you use today in your career from life overseas?
Negotiations. I find that my skills in negotiations increased on the basis that at times I was working with very big employee bases and in very complex environments. And I needed to really think about how do I give people, individuals, or facets of the business what they want so I can ultimately get what I need.
Wonderful. The best thing you have discovered since arriving home is?
Cool summers. And not having to have the air conditioning on 24 hours a day.
The first thing you'd encourage a new repat to do is?
Don't rush into the job market. Come back, settle where you are, get a familiarity of the environment that you're working in, build on your contacts, be clear on what you want to actually do, understand what it's like locally. In a nutshell, Margot, just don't jump into the first thing that may look good or maybe what you think you want because that just builds, potentially can build that or compound that disappointment for you when you come back.
A word, song, or quote that best describes your time overseas is?
I suppose a quote that I learnt was from a very senior person in the UAE government when the company I was working for, we had to have a meeting with them. They said, don't always look for leaks when it rains. Always look for leaks when it's not raining. It was in Arabic, but it was translated. And it always stuck for me, which is don't all of a sudden go into planning and panic mode because you get a leak when it's raining. Look around before it starts raining and make sure you don't have a leak. I know it's not as succinct and translates maybe as well as it could, but it always resonated for me. And it is, don't just look for leaks when it's raining. It was a good one.
Yeah, great. It sounds like you've applied that across career, across life, your planning, your phases. So it's great to see how that, or hear how that's actually translated for you.
Absolutely.
Oh, Mark, you've been really generous with your time. I really have enjoyed our chat. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Margot. It's been fantastic and I've really enjoyed. And as I said, it's a privilege to be part of this.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review, share it with your friends and family, and subscribe for future episodes. For more information on our guests, please head to our website, insyncnetworkgroup.com, where you can check out the show notes and also find more information about our career advisory programs and fabulous community.